Welcome to Inspired, a production of Interfaith Voices. I'm Umbreen Khan. Mm-hmm. 2020 has been a year. Presidential campaign unlike any other. Western wildfires that created post-apocalyptic landscapes. And a global pandemic. This week, the United States crossed yet another threshold as a surge of the highly contagious COVID-19 virus continues to spread. Look, the list of moments likely to be associated with this year is so long. One of the biggest and most remarkable, a national reckoning about race. Across the country, in small towns and big cities, peaceful protesters silently took a knee for 8 minutes and 46 seconds to absorb the brutal and senseless killing of George Floyd. Sadly, the killings didn't stop, nor has the outrage, so much directed externally, at the systems of policing Black and brown communities, as well as the symbols celebrating and memorializing a Confederate legacy. But for many, this summer was a starting point, confronting history, reflecting on privilege, and thinking about race and representation. Suddenly, books often kept in the ivory tower were being featured in retail bookstores, their once obscure authors making the rounds of talk shows. Titles like White Fragility and How to Be an Anti-Racist popped up on bestseller lists and landed in book clubs for adults. But what about the kids? There are not as many titles in which the stories are centered on subjects like identity and characters that are often relegated to the margins. So the University of Pennsylvania's Graduate School of Education decided to make it easier to find books that tell a different story. In their 2020 Best Books for Young Readers, the list highlights stories that, quote, move us beyond cycles of systemic harm and marginalization. And on that list is Fauja Singh Keeps Going, written by religion professor and activist Simranjeet Singh. In the opening pages, readers meet Fauja Singh as a 5-year-old living in a village in Punjab, India, in the early 1900s. It is beautifully illustrated by UK-based illustrator Baljinder Kaur. Now, the pages take readers along Fauja Singh's journey, one that eventually leads him to London, where he began running in his 80s. In 2011, he set a world record at the age of 100, becoming the oldest person believed to have run a marathon. To first-time children's author Simranjeet Singh, this story means so much. Introduce me to Fauja Singh.
Fauja Singh is a global celebrity that not many people know about. Many people in certain communities, like the running community, knows him, and South Asian communities know him. He is the first person to ever run a full 26.2-mile marathon at the age of 100. And so he's...
Whoa, let's just pause right there. How old is he? Is he still with us today?
He is. He's 109 now. He turns 110 in April.
Wow.
And he's this lovely human being. He's retired from running now. I believe he retired at 104.
We should cut him a break. He retired at 104.
Well, there's so many aspects of his story that are inspiring, but one of them is he started running in his 80s as a way to deal with some of the challenges that life had thrown at him. And a big part of that was losing his life partner. His wife died, his son died, and he, at 81, moved from his village in Punjab to London to live with his kids. And so here's this man who's essentially lost everything, and he's moving to this new place where he has no friends. He's lonely and sad, and he has very little to do. And then he finds running, and that's his escape. So in his 80s, he begins running. At 89, he finishes his first marathon, and then he gets faster. And in his 90s, he shatters all the world records for 90 years old and up.
It's an incredible story. And I have this faint memory of hearing about or reading about him in one of the South Asian dailies that float around my house. And I think you were absolutely right. He's a well-known in certain circles, but you're bringing this story out. Did he speak English?
No, he doesn't speak English. He's never spoken English. He speaks Punjabi pretty much exclusively. And so that's part of the immigrant experience as well, right? And he's so reliant on his family to get by. He's also illiterate. He is to this day. I had, and I still do, I'm sure, had this bias that literacy equals intelligence. And I'd never really spent time with someone who couldn't read or write until I started spending time with, and of course he's brilliant. And he's so wise. And so it really helped me shatter my own internal bias around literacy and what that means, and to think about why he didn't have access. And that's because he was disabled as a child.
And what was that disability? You don't name it specifically in the children's book?
We don't know. And he doesn't know himself. So he was the early 1900s in a village in Punjab. So it's not just that they didn't have the language that we do around disability today. It's also that they didn't have access to medicine. Mm. His particular disability was one that he was able to overcome over time. Part of the challenge of writing the book was it's so easy to fall into tropes around disability. And so we ended up actually bringing in disability consultants. Part of the challenge is, and I think about this a lot with my own kids and how I teach in the classroom, you want to introduce your kids, and I want to introduce my kids to these realities in the world that they'll encounter, including, you know, difficult emotions, challenging emotions, different forms of oppression, like racism. We mentioned racism in the book, but you want to do it in a way that's age appropriate. And so we were incredibly thoughtful around these ideas of how we talk about disability. And in Foja's case, we ended up very much based on the advice of disability consultants, focusing very much on his particular experience with disability so that we didn't imply in any way that all disabilities could be overcome with hard work, which is the common trope around disability and incredibly damaging, right? Because the implication then becomes if you're not able to get over your disability, then you're just lazy. You're not trying hard enough, and that's not fair and it's not right. And so it was this really interesting experience for me figuring out how to present these really complicated ideas for elementary school students, like for my own daughter who's 4. There was this one moment when I read the book to my daughter for the first time. There's this image of Foja in middle age combing his daughter's hair. And my daughter, when we got to that page, it was the first time we're looking through the book, and she points at it and she squeals, like she's so excited. And she says, That's you and me every morning. And Aww. Yeah, it's like totally cliche of like
heart melting daddy daughter moment there.
Exactly. And it's like, it was the dream from when I first started thinking about writing a children's book for my kids to see themselves represented and to see me as someone besides, you know, all the negative stereotypes that they get otherwise, like for them to see positive representations of our family. Was like the dream. And so that moment just like totally, you're right. Yeah, it just melted my heart. In this moment especially, it's difficult, but it's also so joyful, like just to be able to spend time with them. And so the real question is like, why do we do other things instead of just enjoying our time with family? And I think for me, it probably comes back to the conviction and the commitment to justice, that our world will be and can be so much better if we put the work in. The children's book especially, growing up, I felt so isolated as, you know, a sick growing up in Texas with a turban and a beard. It's not just that I didn't have friends in the entire region who looked like me. It's also that there was no representation in media spaces. So it was just so isolating. And so when my kids were born, I reaffirmed my commitment to make sure that they never felt that way. I always want them to feel like their stories matter and that there's nothing to be ashamed of when it comes to their identity or their heritage or anything like that.
I appreciate you kind of tracing that back to your experience growing up and not seeing yourself in media. When you talk about social justice, though, what seeded that desire and conviction as you describe it?
I think it would go back to my parents. First and foremost, I think, you know, for them, it was very much an ethical practice that, you know, we are graced with all sorts of blessings and privileges, things that we don't necessarily deserve, but we've received for whatever reason. And it doesn't belong to us. It's not something we take with us when we die. And so what do we do with it? Do we sit around and just enjoy it? Or do we enjoy it and also try to do what we can to ensure other people have access to those same joys and privileges? And so, you know, on the one hand, growing up, my parents could have very easily focused on the racism we experienced. And really, it's so easy to fall into a victimization mindset and to say life is hard for us, life sucks, you know, we have to fight for our survival, which we did, and we still do. But they actually really focused on what are the silver linings, what are the blessings, what are the gifts, and then what do you do about that? And so I think that's become so ingrained within me that it's hard for me to even imagine what a life would look like for me if everything wasn't always a pivot towards how do I make life better for other folks. That's just a part of the politics that I've learned to embody. And it's, you know, it's not inherent. It's definitely something that's been taught to me. And that really comes from watching my parents do that in their own lives and the conversations that I had with them about what it means to be a good person in this world and also what it means to find joy in this world. And my parents always used to remind us, better to give than receive. That was a mantra in our house and something that we really took to heart.
Was there ever a point for you when you encountered a level of racism or xenophobia targeted at you because of your appearance or because of your faith that shook you?
You know, people ask me all the time, have you ever encountered this level of negativity to the point where you wanted to cut your hair or take off your turban? And that's an easier answer for me. Like, no, not really. I mean, I remember as a kid, there were moments, but nothing in recent memory. But stuff that shook me, yeah, absolutely. And I think that's a harder thing for me to talk about or even think about, because those moments are so painful that while they stay in your heart and in your soul, you also psychologically just don't want to think about them. And so you put them aside and you try and lock them up so you don't have to deal with them anymore. When I really felt shook was when I first moved up north. I went up for graduate school in Boston. And I, you know, we have these stereotypes of what these places are. And I really felt like I had left racism behind me. And I was so happy. And, you know, it was the first time I was away from my family. But I was excited to be in a place where I expected to be accepted for who I was and to be around more people who shared my culture and background. And it really shook my worldview to enter into such a place that, you know, around the country we consider to be a liberal bastion, a center for multicultural and multi-ethnic and multi-religious and all these different things. And I get there and I'm getting the same stuff I got in Texas. And then I moved to New York and then I have the same false expectation and I get the same stuff. And those things are important because they help ground us in reality and deal with and confront the ugly truths that we try and avoid. But because I had built up this false expectation, perhaps out of a desire for security and a desire for believing that racism wasn't a problem everywhere, those were really painful moments where I had to deal with the ugliness on the outside, but also internally some of the challenges around how we think about ourselves. Someone will say to me, oh, you grew up in Texas looking like that. What was it like? And in my head, it's so difficult to describe something different because to me, it's all I knew. So it's normal. It's normalized, right? We've normalized it. And so what does belonging look like in that context where you feel like and you've already reconciled for yourselves and you don't want to live in a way where you feel like you're an outsider all the time. And so you figure it out. And I think that's a really common experience for immigrants and immigrant families. And then on the other hand, there's this constant experience and an acknowledgement and a recognition. And, you know, I know it in my head at all times, like there's no place where I am perceived to belong truly. And whether or not I feel like I belong isn't always relevant to how people perceive me. And I think that's part of how racism and xenophobia works, right? So I could feel perfectly at home, and I did growing up in San Antonio or where I live now in New York. And I could feel totally comfortable in my skin and walking around feeling like I'm part of the community and the neighborhood and all that stuff. But there will still be people on the street who say, go back to where you came from, like implying that I don't belong. That happens to me in the States. That happens to me when I'm traveling in other countries. That even happens to me in my family's homeland of Punjab and across India, where I stick out like a sore thumb. And so it's this really interesting experience of knowing in my bones that no matter where I go, I don't fully belong. And people know that, right? Like I stick out, and part of it is my visible identity in a context where, you know, not everyone is wearing a turban and not everyone has a beard. And so, but also the way that I carry myself, the way that I dress, the way that I speak, right? And I could be speaking in my mother tongue of Punjabi and dressed in Punjabi clothes, and people still know that I'm not from there and that I don't belong. And so there's this really strange interplay constantly within me of, I feel like I belong, but I know that people around me don't feel like I belong. When I show up in a place, I'm very conscious of the fact that people see me as an outsider. I'm not overly concerned with making them feel safe, but I am conscious of the fact that I should ensure my own safety because I don't know how other people are reading me and what they might do.
We continue my conversation with activist, writer, and religion professor Simranjeet Singh after this short break. Stay with us. Hi, friends. I hope you're enjoying the show so far. I just want to say thank you. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being part of our community. I don't know if you know this, but we are on the air all the way from Richmond, Virginia to Ketchikan, Alaska, and in so many places in between. We're a national show, and we are a small and mighty team committed to bringing you stories and sounds from around the world that convey not only the diversity and the pluralism of our country, but the beliefs that are shaping our world, our politics, our culture, and the ideas that sustain us and inspire us to think about where we are going. And that brings me to this question. If you value us, if you enjoy listening and appreciate what you're hearing, I want to ask you to take a moment to consider becoming a sustaining member of Interfaith Voices or make a one-time donation at interfaithradio.networkforgood.com. That's interfaithradio.networkforgood.com. Thank you, and let's get back to the show. Welcome back to Inspired, a production of Interfaith Voices. I'm Umbreen Khan. If you are just joining, I'm talking with new children's author, Simranjeet Singh. He's an educator and an activist who frequently offers comment and analysis on religion, racism, and issues of justice. He is also a regular columnist for the Religion News Service and a visiting professor of religion at the Union Theological Seminary in New York City. In August 2020, Jeet Singh authored his first children's book, Foja Singh Keeps Going, published by Penguin Random House. It's since landed on lots of reading lists, including NPR's Best Books of 2020. The story is about the obstacles and triumphs of the 109-year-old Foja Singh. Foja began running in his late 80s as a way to cope with grief and the challenge of immigrating to Great Britain from India. In his 90s, running became a passion, and he began to break world records in the running world. Before the break, Jeet Singh shared how much he longed for a children's book featuring someone like himself, a turban-wearing Sikh, and how his experience growing up in South Texas shaped how he thinks now about race and religion, and why he feels so strongly about the importance of representation in our culture, including literature. Let's get back to our conversation.
You not to psychoanalyze myself. No, you're right. It's not just how I wrote the story. It's also why I chose Fo Jessing and why he's been such an inspiration to me personally, because I feel like the more I've learned from his story and the more time I've spent with him, the more that I see the embodiment of the values that I aspire to inside of this 109-year-old body. And to witness that, it's such an extraordinary thing. I remember the first time I met him, and I remember this thought that I had of how refreshing and reassuring it was to meet someone who lived up to your expectations, right? Like, it's so common for us to put people on a pedestal and to want to believe these things about these people. And then when we finally meet them, we're like, oh, you're not who you said you were. You're not who I thought you were. And Fo Jessing's not like that. You know, I met him when he was 104 for the first time, I believe. And he was so energetic and so funny and so loving and so kind. It just really spoke to me. You know, what I really took away from Fo Jessing's story is this internal drive. Let me say it this way. A part of what happens when you're racialized and you're trying to reconcile the tension between how other people perceive you and how you perceive yourself, to end up in a healthy place, one has to at some point let go of, you know, people are just going to see me this way and there's only so much I can do about it. I even remember the first time we dealt with like pretty serious racism in Texas. I remember my parents sitting us down and saying, you can't control how everyone treats you, but you can always control how you respond. And that to me is the core of resilience. You take what life gives you and you figure out how to run with it. And that's what Fo Jessing did so beautifully, whether it was around disability or whether it was around illiteracy or whether it was around death that led to depression. As I talked to him, those difficulties, they were such an important part of his experience that they shaped who he would become, and how he leaned into those experiences would really inform what his character is as a human being. And so that to me is just like the gold standard. It's a cool story about running, and I love running. It's a cool story about a sick man, and you know, I care about representation and really want to do that. But at the end of the day, these are the values that I want to pass on to my kids around resilience and believing in yourself and just persisting no matter the situation.
You know, it's interesting because as I listen to you, I'm reminded of how much I loved going into and frankly retreating into the library and finding books as a kid and even now as an adult. And, you know, I would look for books with characters that were familiar to me, and I never really found them. And sometimes it would leave me feeling, you know, a bit invisible.
I remember that same feeling of going into libraries and bookstores and always looking for a book with sick characters. Like, I didn't even care what it was. It could even just have a picture of a sick in the background on one random page, and I would be satisfied. But I would be so disappointed walking away. And then what was even more frustrating was that my daughter's born 30 years later, and I go back to those same bookshelves and nothing, like literally nothing has changed. That to me was the moment where I was like, I got to do it. Like, I don't have a choice anymore. I think part of the frustration that I'm feeling now with children's books is, you know, you go into a bookstore and you finally have books with different storylines, the diverse representation, and you walk into a bookstore and there, everything is sort of sidelined as the diversity book, right? Or books for Black readers. And so for me, this book and these books, like, yes, I want them for my kids and I want them for other Desi kids, and that matters. But also I want my daughter's classmates to read these stories and recognize that they're part of mainstream society, right? Like, it's not like we're on the margins and we have our own stories and you have your sort of mainstream or normative stories that are different from ours. Like, I want that connection to happen. Like, that to me is part of what anti-racism work does. That's part of what intersectional justice is about. And I think we have to start a lot younger than we do. And so, yes, this book is the first children's book from a major publisher to feature a sick character. And yes, I'm excited that sick families and sick kids are excited. And I'm excited for my own kids. But I'm also thinking about what a book like this can do for people of all backgrounds. My thesis is that if we can teach our kids to see the humanity in the people who look and seem most different from them, then we can teach them to see the humanity in everyone.
Do you see a need for more books that talk about that challenge through a faith lens?
Absolutely. Part of what I'm trying to do in this book is to provide different nodes of connection for people, right? Like there's something really simple about telling someone's story and for kids to just latch onto them and say, oh, I have those same kinds of experience. I have those same kinds of emotions. I like running too. And that in and of itself does some work. But then what does it do when you take an intersectional lens and a social justice lens and you say, this person is someone who dealt with disability. This is someone who is older. This is someone who dealt with xenophobia and racism. Like all of a sudden, you're providing multiple points of connection that help us go beyond these sort of siloed understandings of oppression and see the bigger picture. I think you're right to point out that faith is another one of those aspects of identity that more often than others actually gets sidelined as something that we don't know how to talk about and something we don't know how to deal with. And I think as I've been trying to have those conversations with my daughter about what it looks like to live with conviction as a Sikh, but also to live with the open-mindedness of someone who embraces pluralism, we want to firmly root ourselves in our traditions, but the only logic we typically give ourselves is one of supremacy. You're either in or you're out. I subscribe to my faith because it's better than the others. And we end up creating a very similar sort of a religious hierarchy as we do with race. That is incredibly damaging. And whether we want to admit it or not, there's no possibility of pluralism when we're operating out of constructs of supremacist thinking, right? Like my faith is better than yours, that's supremacist thinking. And so I think what we need is a new way of thinking about what it looks like to be living with pluralistic ideals while also remaining committed to our own particular faith practices or traditions.
You are well aware that in some religious traditions, supremacy and claiming supremacy is a fundamental tenet. And it's a tenet that people hold on to as a way of not simply defining themselves, but of claiming their right to exert influence over things that are within their control, whether it be their families, whether it be the community norms, whether it be the laws. How do we start having that conversation?
How do we start having those conversations? I'm not sure. But what I do know is that we have, as a collective, normalized discussions around white supremacy in a way that I couldn't have predicted 10 years ago. We as a society have come to agree for the most part, right? Like not everyone, but we come to recognize it as something that's unacceptable and inappropriate given our values. I'm hoping to see something similar around conversations about religious supremacy. It's easy for me to see what religious privilege and religious supremacy looks like because I've been on the receiving end of it. Just like it's a lot easier for people of color and Black folks in particular to see what white supremacy and white privilege looks like because they've been on the wrong side of the equation. Part of what needs to happen is that as we begin unearthing what religious privilege and religious supremacy means, we need to be able to open up these conversations to those on both sides of the equation, those who enjoy religious privilege and perpetrate religious supremacy, and those who are on the receiving end of it. I think right now it just feels like we're too early to engage in that because the logic of religion so often relies on people buying into these ideas of superiority and inferiority, of sacred and profane. It's so hard to unpack that without people feeling like we're challenging their very faith existence. The most helpful trait that one can cultivate is humility. The humility to know that your way of experiencing the world is not the only way. The humility to accept that you might have internalized some ideas that are problematic and that you want to do better. The stakes are extremely high. And we've been socialized and conditioned to understand that to admit any missteps or mistakes when it comes to issues of race and justice is inexcusable in any way. And I think what we really need to do is shift that thinking and to recognize that we all are guilty. And the real problem is that when we recognize it, if we don't do anything about it, then we're doing something wrong.
That was Simranjeet Singh, a religion professor, activist, and the author of children's book, Foja Singh Keeps Going, which made the NPR's best books of 2020. Illustrator is Baljinder Kaur. Simranjeet Singh spends a lot of time working to change perceptions with stories about real people, especially stories like Foja Singh's, one that many of us may have missed. That same impulse motivated One Journey Festival co-founder Wendy Chan. Coming up, the story of the One Journey Festival and how they made some shifts during a pandemic that led to some surprising opportunities for refugee immigrants who are also performers, activists, and artisans sharing their story. You're listening to Inspired, a production of Interfaith Voices. Welcome to Inspired, a production of Interfaith Voices. I'm Umbreen Khan. Now, we are in the midst of the holiday season. In fact, this week marks the beginning of Hanukkah. And for many of us, that means shopping for presents. According to a recent Gallup poll this year, the average American will spend about $800 on gifts. And that's down from $940 in 2019. Making choices this season can be challenging, especially during a pandemic. How can you make sure the gifts you buy are ethically produced and distributed? How much of the money spent on them will actually make it into the artisans' pockets? Those questions are paramount to the founders of One Journey, a nonprofit organization based in Virginia. Creating an opportunity for connection is one of their main activities. Each year, they host the One Journey Festival, that includes a physical marketplace featuring vendors who come to the United States as refugees, artisans and creators from Syria, Afghanistan, Sudan, and beyond showcase and sell their handiwork, everything from clothing and jewelry to foods and original art. And as it has done with almost everything else on the planet, COVID-19 and this pandemic has thrown the organizing model for One Journey out the window. Undaunted, organizers have gone virtual to create the One Journey Holiday Marketplace online. And the operation is managed, well, entirely by volunteers of all ages.
I am 43.
I just turned 24.
The beauty of One Journey is we have people, volunteers from all spectrum of life. We have as young as high school students, college students, and all the way up to people who are in the 80s. It's truly a grassroots effort that is, you know, entirely powered by people who believe in the work.
My name is Wendy Chan. I'm the co-founder of One Journey.
My name is Yogi. I am the marketing lead for One Journey based out of Philadelphia.
I spoke with Chan and Yogi Metapalli, but before we talked about the marketplace, Chan explains their grassroots organization has a goal: change negative perceptions about refugees by creating meaningful opportunities to connect. In 1989, Wendy Chan immigrated to the United States as a young girl. She came here to unite with her extended family, many of whom had fled China as refugees to escape civil war. She co-founded the nonprofit One Journey with Vonda Berniger, also an immigrant with a refugee story. In 1991, as the civil war broke out in Croatia, Berniger and her family fled to Germany.
My co-founder, Vonda Berniger, and I founded One Journey because we were deeply troubled by the anti-refugee, anti-immigrant rhetoric. At the same time, the world was seeing an increase in refugee population. So we asked ourselves, what can we do? And we saw this opportunity to really kind of change, shift that narrative from you know, refugee being cost to our society, being threats to our society, to something that is closer to truth, which is that refugees contribute to our economy. They are talents that we should welcome, and also connecting the community to take actions by introducing them to community organizations that are helping refugees domestically and internationally.
What does One Journey do to accomplish this mission?
What we do is we organize events to educate our audience about the refugee crisis, about the situation that refugees are facing overseas. We also create communities where people can come and see with their own eyes the performance of refugees, artists, and musicians, you know, purchasing art and crafts made by refugee vendors so that they can see with their own eyes the contributions of refugees and have that human connections through our in-person events. We started about 2 years ago, this annual festival to celebrate refugee contribution, their talents, by showcasing, bringing people together through food, fashion, music, dance, what we call the common language of humanity, so that we can all come together in a single place to celebrate together, but also to highlight and learn about different ways that people can contribute and connect and support refugees in their community.
That sounds like fun stuff you're describing there. Food, fashion, art. With COVID, how have you all adapted? What have been the changes that you've decided to kind of make? And how has that impacted what 2020s look like for you?
Given that everything was shut down and we couldn't have any of these in-person events for One Journey, we really needed to pivot to an online virtual model really quickly. In early summer, we created an initiative called Journeys Home. And the idea behind that was, because of COVID-19, there are a lot of artists and performers mainly who cannot perform and therefore cannot earn money. So we wanted to give a platform of artists who normally perform at the in-person One Journey Festival, as well as others, to perform what their art and craft is and have the ability to raise money to support their livelihood. So we did this through the creation of virtual concerts, basically, and that was through Facebook Live, as well as other platforms. And we featured musicians and dancers, and I believe there was even a cooking event. We shared links for donation pages that went directly to them. So they were able to share like their PayPal accounts or their Venmos. So it's very, very direct. So the people from our network who now had access to the performances, the information, as well as the ability to come together as a community, even virtually, to support the refugees and immigrant artists that we weren't able to in person.
Yogi, how did you get involved with One Journey?
I was always passionate about the refugee cause. I was fortunate enough to study abroad in Europe in 2016 at the height of the refugee crisis. I remember wanting to get involved there and just not having the opportunity to. Like, I remember calling like Cardiff Refugee Council like hundreds of times and not really getting anything. And I actually came across an article written about our founder, Wendy, and I read about the message. I reached out. I just missed the 2018 festival. It got started just a little bit after it, but I've been a part of the organization ever since.
Faith really plays a key role in my decision of getting involved in supporting refugees. I started the refugee ministry at my church, and that was the kind of the impetus for me to expand the work to involve more organizations, you know, faith communities to come together and do something at a large scale, such as One Journey Festival. So it's very much rooted in the start of my work. We also get a lot of support from interfaith organizations around the DC area and getting support from the Episcopal Church, including my church, St. George's Episcopal Church of Arlington and the National Cathedral.
What I appreciate about One Journey and, you know, interfaith communities that participate with us is that a lot of the refugees and immigrants we work with have their own religious faiths. But the work that we do is never evangelical. Like, we respect people. We want to help them, you know, be better neighbors and be help them integrate into our communities, but not necessarily with an agenda. And the other part about interfaith organizations that are involved with One Journey is that you know, oftentimes it's really, really difficult to mobilize people.
I wanted to just have you talk a little bit about the backstory about the holiday marketplace.
So the One Journey Holiday Marketplace is really our COVID version of the in-person holiday market. When we started One Journey 2 years ago, we decided to do holiday markets around the season of Christmas so that we can provide a new platform for the refugee artisans and organizations that are selling products to support the refugee programs, to provide them with a new opportunity to give visibility to their work and their products. When COVID hit, we know that we cannot continue to do that, but we still wanted to provide a virtual opportunity for us to connect, give visibility to the artists that we're working currently in our network. However, because of it's a virtual platform, we saw there's more opportunities for us to connect with organizations that are either operating internationally or here in the U.S. And so this year's One Journey Virtual Market is launched by our volunteers. We feature close to 20 organizations and individuals who are refugees or immigrant backgrounds.
Can you give me an example of some of the vendors?
So Daferal, they use food for social good and essentially creating these really delicious sugar-free sweets in order to support the employment of some of the most vulnerable women in their community. They support refugee women and formerly trafficking victims in order to provide a path for them to self-reliance. Yes, so Artisans Beyond Borders, it's a nonprofit that actually has its roots in the interfaith community, and they work with asylum seekers who are stuck at the U.S.-Mexican border and really kind of sell the crafts that are designed and created by these incredible artists, but at the same time able to provide support to those individuals who critically need the funding to support their livelihood on the border. Another organization that I wanted to highlight is Karem Foundation. It is a nonprofit that works with Syrian refugees, particularly Syrian refugee youth and students. And we've been partnering with them since the very first year of One Journey Festival back in 2018. They do some incredibly amazing work operating in Turkey and Jordan.
A large part of how we find the vendors or, you know, how we maintain the relationships are very personal.
If someone's listening and they're connected to an organization or a similar enterprise that's trying to create an economic opportunity by supporting ethical consumption of goods or products and ensuring that the makers or creators are getting those resources directly in their hands, how could they get featured? Because they're struggling with marketing. And one of the things that you really have a grasp on is marketing. How can folks connect or share their story with the One Journey folks?
So if you go to onejourneyfestival.com, there's a page where you can contact us. And, you know, more directly, I think the easiest way for somebody to reach out to us directly, share their story and see if there's a potential to be featured is just to message us on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/onejourneyfestival. I'm the person who manages the pages, so I will most definitely see those messages and respond as soon as we can.
What are you hoping for 2021?
Going into 2021, I think we're going to have probably double the impact because I think we're going to continue with the virtual events, continue expanding our audience online, as well as, you know, be present in more cities and in DC itself, and to have that in-person connection and connect refugees and immigrants to the people in their communities to better, you know, make it feel like home for them. And home doesn't only mean physical spaces. It could be online spaces where they feel supported and where they can be supported financially in other ways as well.
I would add that if we think back about the mission of One Journey is really to shift that narrative, really connecting people to opportunity to support refugees. The more we can create those opportunities to help the community understand who refugees really are, you know, to kind of get to know them at the personal level and to really understand their contributions, the more successful I see One Journey can be. And it's really connecting people to the organizations they're helping refugees, to the various ways that they can support refugees, whether it's through the holiday markets, whether it's through sort of, you know, direct giving or supporting refugee artists and musicians through purchasing their musical products or attending their concerts, and just understanding the different ways that they can support refugees and immigrants across the country, but also internationally, given that we know the refugee crisis is growing at a rapid scale, you know, with all the political instability around the world. And the more people know about how to get involved, the better it is to support the refugee community and initiative. So we see that our impact will be measured and defined by the knowledge of people about the crisis and about ways to get involved in the community.
And that's full circle, because one of the struggles that I had was I didn't have a way to get involved. You know, I called the refugee councils. I looked for organizations in New York when I came back from studying abroad. I couldn't find a person. I couldn't find an organization that I could directly get involved in. But you know, and I came across One Journey. So as a volunteer, it gave me an opportunity to give back. But the organization itself provides many opportunities for people of the community to engage in a meaningful way when they might not know where to get started. And making that easy and tangible and for them and being in front of them, I think is what we do best. So this might take it in a little bit of a different direction, but I think what came to light during the summer of 2020 is that people have a really tangible way to effect change by deciding where to spend their money. And I'm saying this in the context of, you know, the horrific, you know, race-fueled incidents that have happened over the summer, as well as the unfair practices that are practiced by giant corporations that we all know who they are. And, you know, by choosing carefully and by being conscientious of where you spend your money has a huge impact on, you know, communities that are normally underserved, as well as forcing the bigger companies to adopt practices that are more in line with the values of their customers than not. So when we make the choices with our money and being conscientious and not just going with whatever is the easiest way, we have the ability to impact that change on both corporations while also impacting communities that often don't, you know, often overlooked.
And I just also wanted to add, as person of faith, we see that our resource, our wealth, our money is really a gift from God. And so I think there's that additional meaning of what is a good way for us to be a good steward of God's, you know, blessings of these financial resources on us. And as we think about that, I think, you know, making conscious decisions about purchases that takes into account the cleanness of the supply chain, the impact of the purchase on the community, on the individual's life, whether it's the worker's life or the impact of the employees, I think that's particularly important.
I appreciate you sharing, both of you, your perspectives on that. This is not a religious show per se, but one that explores how faith and beliefs shape the way that the world works. So it is always meaningful to see how collaborations and stories invite all kinds of allies to stand up for and think about the most marginalized and vulnerable people in our communities in a way that doesn't see them as having deficits, which is one of the things I love about this, is that you really are telling a story about the positive contributions, the wealth of ideas and the art and the food and all the various ways in which people contribute that doesn't reflect necessarily just one aspect of their identity or station or position at that moment. I have had so much fun going through and making some little stocking stuffer purchases myself on the One Journey site. Hope my family likes it. Thank you. Thank you both for being available. That was Wendy Chan of Northern Virginia and Yogi Metapalli of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. They're both volunteer leaders with the One Journey nonprofit organization that can be found at onejourney.org. We are closing this week's episode with music from a performance by Abraham Mwinda. He's Congolese-born, Kenyan-raised, singer, songwriter, and rapper from Lexington, Kentucky, who now lives in San Diego, California. One Journey hosted a virtual concert for Abraham, connecting him to a new audience of supporters.
They say east or west, home is best, but where is home? Is it the place that embraced me, the place that raised me, or the place where I was born? So where is home? Where is home? My whole life I had to answer the question, where are you from? Hey, you look kind of different and you kind of talk funny. You must be far from home. So where is home? Where is home?
That's all for this week's episode. A special thanks to our founder, Maureen Fiedler, MC Yogi for our theme music, and to our listeners who make this program possible because of your generosity. And if you'd like to learn how to support Interfaith Voices, please visit interfaithradio.org, where you can sign up for our newsletter, subscribe to the podcast, and learn more about us. This week's producers include Kevin McCarthy and Kimberly Winston. I'm your host and executive producer, Umbreen Khan. Stay safe, stay connected, and we'll see you next week.